Welcome to the Azure Podcast, a weekly podcast to keep you up to date on what's new on our cloud platform, Microsoft Azure. Your hosts, Cynthia Crane, Evan Basilik, Sujit DeMello, Kendall Roden, Kel Teeter, and Russell Young discuss a different service or solution on each show, with subject matter experts to explain how to get started, how different services work, and how to make decisions in tricky scenarios. You can find out more about our podcast at azpodcast.com or follow us on Twitter at Azure Podcast.
Well, welcome back to the Azure Podcast. This is episode number 334, being recorded on the 10th of June, 2020, with Mikkel. I am Sujit, and on Teams with me, I have Kale, Cynthia, Kendall, and special guest Mikkel, who we're going to get to in just a minute. But before that, let's talk about all the news that happened this week in Azure. Let's see. I noticed that you guys put a bunch of updates in the show notes. What grabs your attention? Who wants to go first? See, Kale, I think you put something in there.
Yeah, I got one here that related to blockchain stuff. So Ion launched this week, and there's a blog post up about this. So if you're interested in decentralized IDs, this is a technology that we've been working on for quite some time with research and the identity team, and it's in beta right now. So there's the Decentralized Identity Foundation, which is not just Microsoft, that's made up of a consortium of other folks as well who are helping contribute to this. Ion is one of the products or implementations using Bitcoin as the underlying storage mechanism for a decentralized ID, along with IPFS and Mongo and a couple other things that go along with that. So it's a nice write-up here that kind of shows, you know, the architecture and how this thing actually works. It has nothing to do like specifically with cryptocurrency or any of that kind of stuff. It's more being used as a kind of an anchor point for these IDs so that you can always point back and know that it's true, which is the real value of that.
Awesome. Cynthia, did you want to pick on any of these topics?
The one that I saw, I haven't put it on there, but there are some updates coming out of the Azure Spring Cloud. So if any of our listeners are doing development on Spring, there are a lot more integration that just came out, including debugging, CI/CD pipelines, custom domain names, there's IntelliJ ID support, Azure Monitor integrations, and also managed identity integrations. So I'll put in the link for people that are using Spring Cloud.
Awesome. And I know Kendall's on, but she's having a problem with her voice, so she'd normally cover this. I'm going to cover it for her, and it's kind of related to our guest today. But AKS now has the integrated application gateway feature, which is available. This is the feature where normally you'd use like an Nginx kind of controller or something or a pod to run your ingress controller. Instead of that, you could use the built-in feature in Azure, which uses the application gateway as the ingress controller. And this was in preview before, and now this feature is generally available in AKS. It would be, I think there's a, maybe we can ask Mikkel to talk about it later during the show, but that is something that is currently widely available. What else do we want to cover here?
There's one other one that I thought was pretty cool for folks, especially in enterprise around Azure policy. So if you're using Azure policy for implementing policies and constraints and things like that around things that your corporation's doing in Azure, there's some support now for Azure Cosmos DB in there, which is pretty slick. So it can cover all kinds of different things inside of there. Basically, you can set kind of standards and policies that you can use inside your company for Cosmos now. So things like throughput, RUs, even stuff like advanced threat protection, things like that along with it. So pretty nice that we see that starting to permeate throughout Azure so people can control their cloud much easier.
Awesome. Then another kind of AKS-related feature, this is something that I've seen a lot from my customers, is, you know, upgrading AKS can be a pain in the neck. You know, it sometimes can be quite intrusive on the applications that are running there. So a couple of features they put in there now is, and also if you have a lot of nodes in your node pool, the updates are done one node at a time. So it could take a long time to do the update. So a couple of kind of new features they're announcing here, improvements, I should say. One of them is you know, they're going to be able to make these updates to some of the OS components without requiring a full kind of reinstall of the new of all the software when a new version of Kubernetes is being deployed. So you could kind of do it on a more fine-grained level there. And the other thing is they allow you to do some of these updates now in parallel across multiple nodes at a time. Of course, you know, still making sure that we're not going to be short on capacity or some kind of fault the main thing. So those are a couple of updates that have been announced. And Mikkel, feel free to jump in and chime in on any of these. I know these are some close to where you're at.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, the node image upgrade and the Mac search features that you were talking about, so do there is being long sought after. Both of them are preview features right now. But basically, it gives you a much more fine-grained control about, you know, how to actually do your upgrade operations. I would say, however, that there's also a pattern emerging where, you know, the fact that you have node pools in your clusters today, and a lot of customers do, basically using node pool as a concept for upgrades. So instead of doing, you know, upgrading node pools where you need to do either one VM at a time, or with Mac search, you can set a percentage of the nodes that we can upgrade at a time in batches. You actually add new node pools to your clusters. So you get a whole new set of VMs you can migrate over. You can do a gradual roll from the existing node pools that runs the old version to the new node pools. And that adds in, you are basically able to implement a blue-green deployment strategy for these kind of upgrades. And you always have the fallback option of the old node pool. That's definitely a different kind of strategy you could apply here as well.
Okay, so were there any other updates you guys want to cover this week?
I think that's it.
Awesome. All right. Well, then let's turn the mic over to our special guest, Mikkel. Mikkel, thank you so much for joining us today. We love talking about AKS on the Azure podcast, and it's, you know, especially the area that you've been working on. But why don't you give our listeners a sense for what you do in Azure, what your passion is, and what you'd like to discuss today?
Yeah, thanks, Ajit, and thank you for having me here on this podcast. So my name is Mikkel Mørk-Heinhøj, and I'm a program manager in the Azure Application Platform team. So the Azure Application Platform team is the team that handles the broader set of application or developer-focused services that we have inside Azure. So it's things like app services, functions, logic apps, the event services around Service Bus, EventOps, and also the container and microservices-based services such as AKS, Azure Kubernetes Service, ACI, Azure Container Instances, and also Service Fabric, and the recently released ARO, Azure Red Hat. Red Hat is another one of those.
Mm-hmm.
I've been working in the product teams for the last 5 years, and I think my main, you know, the main thing that drove me here was really, you know, coming from a developer productivity angle, like help developers build great solutions in the cloud. So I spent my first part of my tenure there in the developer division inside Microsoft and building developer tools for Azure. So, you know, things like doing local debugging in containers with the intent of deploying them into the cloud was some of the stuff I've been working on. I've been working on Service Fabric development tooling for a while. And then moving over to the actual service teams, done PMing or program management, both within Service Fabric, again, focusing on developer experiences in there. And have spent the last year or so focusing on Windows containers inside AKS, and been part of the team who very recently brought that capability to a general availability.
So it's interesting that, you know, you focus a lot on application developers and their view. Do you see, so, and you know, when you talk about Windows containers, is that an ask that you've seen from the application development community, or is that an ask that enterprises have, you know, have requested more from a compliance perspective? What's the driver for us introducing a Windows version of AKS?
So I think the rise of container technology and how it gives you the ability to go and rethink your operations around, you know, any kind of application has been, you know, if not specifically developer productivity, then maybe operations productivity, a different kind of productivity there, is one of the things that I had very easy to relate to, given my previous experiences as well. And I think the coming from a world of having built .NET applications and having helped customers operate on, and also operated .NET applications myself, I think the easiest way for people in the same with the same kind of experience having to deal with this today, sort of the best picture to paint here is your usual ASP.NET application that you need to run in some sort of higher scale deployment, where things like high availability and the ability to scale out on demand, and consider how you solve these things in more of a standard data center approach, where you need to have these servers up and running and IIS is installed. You might run multiple web applications inside these IIS servers, and now you need to build an HA. You need to deal with things like how do you failover, how do you upgrade these, and it all involves multiple set of servers or multiple server farms, and even distributing these, and moving applications on top of all this compute power is really, really hard. I mean, the finest granularity almost that you have is to some degree your VMs or your servers. Now, if you think about what you can do with containers, like you can take just a single application, package it together with an IIS and everything inside your Windows container, and by deploying it into an orchestration solution like Kubernetes, for instance, now you get HA even by running a single instance. Now, there might be some failover if a server goes down or if the container has to restart, the application restarts or whatever, but there's always a compute resource available for that application to automatically recover onto. It's not like you need to have, more of these consistently running. I mean, you probably should for any any sort of demand or requirement for some sort of high availability. But the fact that you can do that, the fact that you can decouple these core compute or the servers themselves from your applications and repackage, just gives you a way of modernizing your whole operations process around these applications that were that were written for a different time, where it wasn't necessarily cloud and sort of the cloud operations, processes that were mainstream.
Yeah, I had one question, and this is probably a basic one for you, and that would be around support for, so traditionally, or up to a certain time here, we were using Linux containers with AKS, and we have Windows containers as well. Can I mix those? Or is it like, no, when I deploy a cluster, I have to determine at that point, I'm going to use Windows or Linux in this cluster out? It's probably a basic question, but I thought maybe our listeners would be interested.
No. It's a question we get a lot. From an upstream perspective, when I say upstream, I mean, if you take a Kubernetes distribution that comes directly, or if you go and build Kubernetes yourself directly out of the upstream Kubernetes repository, you're able to go and deploy master components of Kubernetes onto Windows. I'm actually not 100% sure to the degree that we, even from upstream perspective, we recommend that today. I remember a year ago when it was announced product grade quality upstream, it wasn't a recommendation to go and run master server components on Windows, but it's possible to do so. So in those cases, you can build sort of pure Windows clusters, as well as you can, of course, build pure Linux clusters. But you can in all scenarios, you can, because Kubernetes is built in this way where you have a certain set of nodes that run, some, your master components, meaning you need to have a place where you host your etcd configuration database, there's the API server and all these things, the scheduler, all of those needs to be hosted somewhere. But you can also have nodes that you dedicate just for your workloads. So we talk about master and worker nodes in that sense. And in any cluster, independent of, what operating system are running those master nodes, you can always mix in worker nodes of a different operating system. And it doesn't even, it's not even, just the operating system. It could also be the version, right? So from a Windows point of view, in some situations, you need to have different versions of the host server, for instance, you can have multiple Windows host versions inside the same cluster while still having Linux as being the masters. Now, moving into AKS as a managed Kubernetes offering, today we don't we have a requirement to have Linux nodes inside your cluster. Now, we do a fully managed hidden master component hosting for you, which means that you never see the VMs where the actual master components are run when you're in AKS. But on the worker node side, we have a concept we call node pools. We talked about that early on. And we need a set of system node pools, or at least one system node pool in an AKS cluster, because we have some system components that can only run on Linux. So the way that we have Windows capability in AKS is when you create a cluster and you get your system pool, the default system pool to begin with, you can add additional node pools. And when you add a new node pool, you choose whether that's based on Windows and Linux. So by default, you get the capability of mix and match operating systems. And what's a great benefit of doing that, and we see a lot of customers using it, is that you have a great ecosystem around containerized different kind of services around Kubernetes. And the typical scenario is your ingress. If you want to have a central ingress proxy that you use inside your cluster, there's a wealth of options for Linux to do ingress proxies. And there are hardly any on Windows. I think there's probably one or two you can get to run there, but it's not a thing we would recommend for production usage. But because you now have these mixed modes cluster and you have full network connectivity across the different operating systems, you're able to take a Linux-based ingress proxy, host them in your Linux node to actually serve, you know, your .NET framework applications running on your Windows nodes.
That's great. And if you were only interested in, let's say, Windows workloads, right, what's the minimum set of that initial Linux node or node pool customers should think about? I mean, obviously, they're going to need one of them for your system components. Is that like a single node installation is good enough for that? Should they have maybe a two node installation or three node for backup? What's the general recommendation there? As a minimum set, because obviously there's no immediate customer value or application on those nodes.
Yeah, the minimum recommendation is to actually run three nodes. And it goes back to upgrade scenarios and stuff like that. While you go and upgrade and to prevent failures, that's a minimum recommendation. There are some system components, particularly DNS. We run Core DNS inside AKS, and Core DNS will scale out the number of Core DNS pods depending on the overall capacity you have in your cluster. So there's a certain ratio between if you ended up running 200 Windows nodes in that cluster, you probably need a few more than three Linux nodes, because some of these DNS components would, you know, maybe scale out to like 5, 6, 7 pods. And if you then kept running these across three nodes, you probably need more resources there. So three as a minimum, but consider the ratio depending on the set of worker nodes you would have as well.
Awesome. I think Kendall, you want to say something? Go ahead.
Yeah, sorry. So my voice is a little gone, but this is one thing that's a bit nuanced there. And feel free to correct me if I'm wrong here, but you do have to actually specify that you want to, like, using, I think it's chains and tolerations, right? That you basically want to schedule the Windows containers onto the Windows node pools. That's just something that's a bit of a little gotcha to anybody that's new. So you have to think about where they're going to be scheduled. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, there's a few different ways of impact scheduling decisions in Kubernetes, right? One of them is using taints and tolerations. So what taints does is you can take a certain node, or in the case of AKS, you do it on a node pool basis, and you add a taint to that, and it's basically an arbitrary labeling with some scheduling directions on it, which means that for any workload to be able to consider that node as an option to be deployed onto, the workload needs to come with a toleration saying that it actually tolerates that taint. So that's one of these ways you can impact. And what we see customers do, and what's also a sort of a good standard recommendation, is that you go and taint your Windows node sort of out the gate to begin with. And it's mainly because the main reason is that Kubernetes doesn't make scheduling decision based on the operating system or even operating system versions or even architectures that run on the worker nodes. You have to impact that. The scheduler doesn't take that into account by default. So if you take any, you know, almost any random Helm chart out there to deploy, an ingress controller or a monitoring solution or, you know, a sort of a daemon set that, you know, target Linux hosts, these Helm charts aren't built in a way where it's easy for you to, you know, tell the scheduler that they can only run on Linux, because a lot of these ecosystem solutions, they tend to ignore the fact that there could be Windows nodes inside the Kubernetes cluster, which in most cases is also the case. So by tending your Windows nodes sort of out the gate, you sort of shield yourself from falling into this pitfall where you have, you know, things that were supposed to run on Linux now starting to run on Windows. There are other ways of impacting scheduling. Node affinity is another concept you can use to give either preferences or requirements, or you can simply use node selectors. But there's a different reasons why you want to use one or the other.
I know when we had talked about the Linux nodes, I think it's well published that we're using Ubuntu, whatever, 16.x as the OS. What should people be thinking about the Windows nodes? What exact version of Windows are we using there?
In AKS, we support the latest long-term servicing channel release of Windows, which is Windows Server 2019. AKA RS5, AKA 1809, even though 1809 is a semi-annual release, it's the same bits that you have underneath. But Windows Server 2019 is the version, which means that the Windows containers you can run in AKS today have to be built off of a 2019 base image as well, basically it's the tag LTSC 2019. Now, we expect to upgrade to a newer Windows version, sort of in the near-term future. It's probably still a few months out because there's some bigger changes we do to the Windows stack in terms of container runtime and also enabling Hyper-V as an option inside AKS.
I know you said... I'm sorry, go ahead.
Sorry, no, I was going to ask you actually about the enabling Hyper-V. I'm assuming that's related to the Hyper-V containers, which were... I know I used to talk to my customers about like the Linux containers on Windows Story, and so I'm just kind of curious... Will that kind of Hyper-V lightweight utility VM, from what I understand, that provides the isolation of the kernel, feel free to demystify everything I just said after I'm done asking the question. but that's going to be available for even Linux workloads, right? Like, would that be something you could run with Linux and Windows containers?
Yes, it will eventually. There's a few things sort of in the stack that need to line up. And to start demystifying all the stuff you said, this could be a longer talk. But basically in Windows, there are two ways of running a container, two types of containers, what we call process-based isolation and Hyper-V-based isolation. Process-based isolation is similar to what you do in Linux, where we encapsulate by using a thing in Windows called an NT job object, which is a way where you can reference a set of processes together. So things like, you know, the resource control and stuff like that is applied to an NT job object, and then there's a special Windows disk driver to take care of sort of the disk layers for the containers. So that's very much equivalent to what you do in Linux, where you have things like C groups to isolate the container, the processes associated with the container. If you look at Hyper-V, what we actually do is we run a Hyper-V VM. But as you say, we have this thing we call the utility VM, which is a purpose-built Windows thing that we run in Hyper-V, and then we actually run our containers inside that Hyper-V. And that's how we get the kernel isolation on the Windows side. And because you know that from running Hyper-V on your Windows, Windows 10 today, you could actually run Linux inside that Hyper-V, we are actually able to also run Linux containers inside Hyper-V. Hyper-V has not graduated in Kubernetes upstream beyond experimental, and there are some reasons in terms of how Kubernetes uses container runtime and the underlying APIs in Windows, where we need some changes both in the container runtime layer to enable Hyper-V in fully production grade scenarios upstream Kubernetes. So there's a few things here we need to have lined up before we can give Hyper-V capability inside AKS. I don't expect us to have, you know, the Linux version of this running the same time we get Hyper-V for Windows. There's basically some more work in those underlying layers that needs to be done, and that's not the current priority. But it will eventually be a way where you can also get kernel-level isolation for Linux pods.
Kaylee had a question.
Yeah, just switching gears a little bit, you had mentioned developer experience, you know, when you first started talking there. So as someone who does a lot of development, I'm always in VS Code or something like one of these tools working on things. And if I'm building my containers in there, I was interested, is there any kind of glue there or any kind of nice tooling that our listeners should be aware of to make it easier for them to start using some of this stuff in Azure?
Yeah, I mean, across the board, there's a lot of great extensions on VS Code specifically, both to get insight in and work with the development towards Kubernetes. I would say that from a from a developer experience as such, we actually see more customers who set up in a way where the developer's concerns sort of end sometimes even before the container is created. Right. The developers then in those scenarios typically output what they would output for an application to be hosted in any kind of environment in any way, which means that it's typically being fed into some kind of pipeline that might be, that might be run by someone else that actually goes and produces the container image to eventually go ahead and be deployed. So it's not given in a lot of scenarios that containers are sort of in the what we typically refer to the inner loop of the developer, what they do between debugging. But it definitely could be, and there's a lot of great tools in VS Code. From the Windows specifically side, if you have .NET framework application targeting Windows, with Visual Studio there is tooling to actually debug inside containers if you want to, and there are also We also have a few things coming in terms of ensuring and enabling an easy migration of things that are already running. Now, we already have a little bit of that in Visual Studio where you can go from code to container and add Docker capability. But we're also looking into options where you can actually go from things that are already running inside your infrastructure containerizing and move them into a solution like AKS.
And kind of on the same vein over there, when migrating, if you have a standard ASP.NET app that you've been running on-prem for a long time, now you want to containerize it, what should the developers be thinking about? Like, what kind of changes should they be looking at doing just to make sure that they're not going to shoot themselves in the foot when it runs in AKS?
Coming from what, sorry? Coming from?
From a standard Windows, like, if you were just deploying this on a Windows box today on-prem, and now you're ready to throw it into AKS. I'm assuming that some changes would have to be made to the app, or are you saying that we could just take it as is?
To a large degree, you can. It's not as much the move into AKS that is the big thing. It's the move into a container. And I think the few things to think about there is how do you do configuration? Now, containers are, designed around the concept of being immutable, deployable objects. And, just going back to the ASP.NET thing, typically as you build, you might run a web transform, and then you actually end up stamping your configuration inside the container. Now, what you really want to do with the container is you want to have the configuration loaded at, runtime as you start up the container. And typically you either do that by file loading or you do by injecting environment variables and stuff like that. So there's a typical pattern where customers want to think about getting configuration into the application by different means than having it built inside the container or part of the build output at least. That's one thing. The other thing would be logging. containers, again, it's built around this idea that, you host console applications and the mainstream way of outputting information from application is through standard output, so basically console output. Now, again, most existing Windows applications don't do that. They either have some structured logging that ends up, through ETW and into the event log or just writing to files. But again, you have to remember that those files inside a container would be stuck in the container, so you need some kind of mechanism to pull them out. I know the Windows team has been working on what they call a bridge tool to help solve some of these logging issues. So there's definitely things you can look at there to help solve that. I think those are the main things, actually. Yeah.
I mean, the two that I was thinking about, you mentioned one, the event log, right? And a lot of Windows apps write to the event log for errors or things like that. A, is that going to be available? And B, is that a good idea? And similarly, the reading the registry. What are those assumptions that we should make that they're not? We shouldn't do that in AKS or in Windows containers.
Oh, you can definitely do it. The hard thing is how do you get it out from the container again? How do you get like configuration changes into the container? Right. So that's where you probably want to, at least from the configuration side, you probably want to change strategy. There's a few examples where customers have done things around how to, you know, make it easier to work with things like web transforms or just, you know, config transformations as part of your container build. And from the logging specifically, there is a log bridge tool. I think it's called log bridge tooling that the Windows team has created, who can help you actually, you know, listen to the event streams that you put into event log today and then output them to standard out so that any, you know, generic monitor or any monitoring solution you have across your Kubernetes cluster will then be able to also pick those events up without you having to change code.
What about like from the security side? I know like a big portion, the big reason why people use Windows is because they really like the fact that, you know, that's domain joined machines and the authentication, the integrated authentication, et cetera, right? That's like the big reason why people love Windows or running apps in Windows. Are we going to lose any of those capabilities going into this new AKS world?
Currently, so the way that you would do a thing like integrated authentication in the containerized world today and also on Kubernetes is through group managed service accounts. So basically, you're able to have the container identity pick up a group managed service account as it's being executed. And that way you can build, you know, all the Kerberos trust and stuff you need for integrated authentication. Today, the way the GMSA works on Windows, it still requires the host to be domain joined. And this is one of these things that doesn't rhyme with cloud, where, you know, things comes and go away and, you know, a new server mm-hmm. comes along and you don't know what domain, you know, identity for it takes. So we are looking at solving that as part of a, you know, an upcoming release as well. So basically, there's an easier way to have containers obtain a group service managed account identity and then enable integrated authentication. Today, because the way the AKS as a service is built, it's hard for us to support that you would go and domain join your nodes. Now, we just, in the beginning, we talked about this upgrade feature, where the way that we go and upgrade a node pool today is like, we don't run a Windows update and reboot. We give you a new node based on the new version. And when the new node is ready, we delete the old one because, I mean, it's cloud, right? So it's the cat, it's the pets versus, it's not the cats versus, it's the pets versus cattle we talk about here, right? And in a cattle world and domain joining, it just doesn't work. There are means to circumvent this, but it's really, really hard for support. So it's not a thing we go and, you know, advocate and say that we straight out support. We do have another solution in Azure, which is called AKS Engine. AKS Engine is a way where you can easily templify building Kubernetes cluster that you don't have run and manage inside Azure, which basically means compared to AKS, there's a lot more management on you. You have to manage the master components and master nodes as well. If you do that, you're sort of all in controls, you know, from the whole stack. And that's a solution where you could go and domain join nodes. But just be aware that you're in a world with a lot more operations and management that's on you.
Awesome. This is great stuff. Thank you, Mikhail. Guys, any more questions for Mikhail before? And Mikhail, what should this is now generally available, so there's no special requests, et cetera, right?
It's all general available. You don't need any preview thingy. Just go ahead and create. I think today, any AKS cluster you create, which uses, there's two pre-requirements here. One is you need to make sure that you're using scale sets as you're backing your node pool. I actually think that's also the standard today. That's the default today. The only thing that's not default is the network option. So we have two network modes in AKS. We have the overlay network, which is called or basic network mode, which is based on KubeNet. And then we have the advanced network mode or the bridge network, which is based on Azure CNI. You have to run Azure CNI to have being able to add Windows nodes into your AKS cluster. So any AKS cluster you go and create today and you choose the advanced networking mode, you're able to add Windows nodes in there and start running your Windows containers.
I do remember one thing that I remember shooting myself in the foot with Windows Node is that you have to remember to set the password, right, when you create the cluster. And if you don't do that, I had to recreate the whole cluster from scratch. Is that still the case? Or I don't know where we're at with that.
It's a cattle thing. Well, you're able to give us a password that you want us to add as the host level password for your Windows nodes when we create the cluster. But you should never, ever use it. There should be no reason for you to get onto those nodes. If you don't, we'll just generate one for you. If you get in the situation where you don't know what the password is, there is actually ways, because the VMSS models are exposed and the VMSS resources are exposed in AKS, you can go to the VMSS model and you can, you know, you can change the password. You would have to bring up new nodes to then actually get the password enforced. The other way to do remote access to nodes is there is, by default, there is SSH access turned onto the nodes. So if you have the SSH key that you use to remote into your Linux node, you could actually use the SSH key to also SSH into your Windows nodes. And from personal experience, it's always fun to, you know, remote into a Linux container to SSH into a Windows node to finally get PowerShell up and running, and, you know, then try to copy files back from that chain of, you know, connection. Is just like, it's, anyways, it's fun though.
Yeah, I'd lose track of files very quickly. Yeah.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
Awesome. No, that's great. Appreciate that little tidbit there. So, any more questions for Bikel before we let him go?
I think this was great. Thanks for coming on and talking to our listeners about this. I'm sure they'll find it beneficial. I thought it was awesome. So thanks.
Cool. Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. No, thanks, Mikael. Appreciate it. And if you have any resources you want to add with the show notes, just send them to me and I'll add them along with the recording. All right.
Cool. Thanks.
Sounds good. Take care.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you have any thoughts, questions, or just want to connect, find us on Twitter at Azure Podcast. Background music has been taken from ccmixer.org under the Creative Commons license. We hope you'll tune in again soon to keep learning with us.